Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Arkady Martin, a speculative fiction writer, and in her secret identity, Dr. Anna Linden Weller. She's an historian of the Byzantine Empire and a city planner. She writes about border politics, rhetoric, propaganda, and the edges of the world. And coincidentally, all of this is wrapped into her first novel, A Memory Called Empire, published in March by Tor, a great publishing house for science fiction for the past gazillion years. A Memory Called Empire takes us on a journey in time and space to a place that is so far alien to our world which should be worlds, and yet is also so familiar. Politics, betrayal, trust, and culture bind together this work in such a way that we marvel at the labyrinthine texture of an empire that mirrors those that Arkady studies and even names the characters, many unpronounceable by me, in the same manner or mirror as ancient cultures on Earth. The book opens doors to the reader that we didn't even know existed, but also draws on the legacies given us by so many other writers of the last two centuries. So with that, welcome, Arkady, and thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So here we are on a mediocre world revolving around a mediocre star on the outskirts of a spiral in a mediocre galaxy in the suburbs of a galactic core within a blah local group. So do you think that somewhere out there a galactic empire actually exists?
I wouldn't rule it out, but it won't look anything like the ones I've written about, because the ones I've written about are full of humans, and we haven't managed that yet.
Well, so what about that the old saw that we briefly discussed before we began, that a world that's technologically advanced enough to reach the stars is also just advanced enough to destroy itself? Pretty much where we are today, except for the fact that we haven't done anything for the past 50 years.
Well, I mean, it could happen, but I don't rule out that somebody's going to get through that filter. Maybe it'll be us. Maybe there are lots of people out there who are just sort of waiting to see if we do. I'm pretty agnostic on alien spacefaring civilizations. We'll see.
So how and why did you draw on all your other expertise and areas of interest as you wrote this book? What was your rationale behind weaving it all together?
Oh, God. So what happened was I had just finished my dissertation for my PhD, which was in Byzantine history, and I'd been writing about diplomats on the edges of the Byzantine Empire and the letters they wrote to each other. And I was completely obsessed with what I had been writing about, which is a good thing because you need to be obsessed to write a dissertation. Otherwise, it is just a horrible slog. And having finished it, I kept thinking about them, but also I was very tired of writing about them in that academic way. But the ideas and the concepts, like what makes the narrative of empire compelling, how do people try to keep it, what happens where empire runs up against a very strong but very much less powerful culture complex on its edges, how do people negotiate all that stuff? All of that I was not at all done with. And I've been writing short fiction for a long time and had been decently successful at publishing it. And out of some kind of masochism, I decided that having finished one very long project, I clearly needed another one and started writing a novel. And the novel turned out to pretty much be a place where I could explore those ideas about empire, about assimilation, about seduction and the dangers of the colonized mind, except in a way that I could put people who I got to write about, I got to make up, as opposed to people I had to discover in manuscript.
Why is the colonized mind dangerous?
Oh, it's dangerous for the person whose mind has been colonized because you can't trust that what you like is real. It's terrible. And then it's also, I tend to push back really hard against the idea that just because you like something that was imposed on you by a colonizing culture means that you don't really like it. Maybe, like, actually you do, even if you would have never been exposed to it had your culture not been colonized. Like, the things we like are genuine likes, even if they are deeply problematic. And I'm very interested in that tension.
It's interesting because we all kind of have colonized minds in a way. I mean, of our own making or not. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, we live in society.
Yeah, and I have no idea if you're really at the end of this conversation or if I'm just, if I just made you up. I don't know, and I never will, and I actually never will. So your epigraphs. The first is clear, lucid, and remarkably true. Our memory and our minds, for that matter, reflect a much more perfect world than the universe. It's happened to me so many times that people that are no longer with me, I can give them life that they no longer have. But the second, the second epigraph is so obscure that I have to ask you why and how does it inform the book? And I kind of have an idea, but it's really nebulous. It's kind of like the cover of a jigsaw puzzle box, which I guess is what
it
an epigraph should. Go ahead.
The second epigraph is from, it's my own translation of a letter written by one of my Byzantine diplomats, Nikephoros Oranos, who was the provincial governor of the city of Antioch in the early 11th century. And it's a letter he wrote home. He wrote home to Constantinople to one of his, basically one of his school friends, more like graduate school than like elementary school, but still a school friend. And what he's doing is he is talking about longing, and he's talking about the sort of reassembly of the center of the world, which for him is Constantinople, whenever he gets a letter, whenever he feels like he's connected to his people again. And also, it's a really beautiful letter. Like, I love it linguistically. Your mouth and its flowers. I mean, how much better can you get than that? And I picked that one to contrast with the De Maupassant epigraph because I wanted, as you see throughout the rest of the book, the chapter epigrams, which are all in-universe, have a LaSalle Station epigram and a Tixkalonli Empire epigram. So in a way, those two are also a LaSalle Station epigram and a Tixkalonli Empire epigram. They're just from our world.
Well, your explanation kind of makes me, one way makes me feel smart because the mouth and its flowers was my favorite part of that as well. But it also makes me feel dumb because the only thing I really know about Antioch is the holy hand grenade of Antioch and Monty Python's Holy Grail.
And the number of your counting shall be three.
So, okay, well, we're here to sell your book. So, let's.
I mean, I can tell you about Antioch if you like, but it's not really about the book.
No, that's right. We are here to sell your book. Remember that. So let's talk about the story a little bit. And also, why is it book one? Well, I know why it's book one, but how did you decide that it would be book one? But let's tell, first of all, talk a little bit about the story.
Okay, so in a way, it's a classic portal fantasy in which a young, clever person goes through a portal to another world and has to deal with what she finds there. But of course, it's also not like that at all. It's also a Le Carré-style spy novel about whether you can believe the evidence of your own eyes and your lying mind. Essentially, the story is Mahit Desmar, who is probably about 25 or 26, really on her first professional assignment out from her little mining station on the corner of the universe, is made ambassador to the big, scary empire, Tixkalan. And she has always wanted to go there her whole life. She is into her culture, into that culture, the way that, to be pejorative for a moment, the way that American kids obsessed with anime are called weeaboos. You can imagine that Mahit is sort of that for Tixkalan. She's really into it. So she's very excited about this. And she also has with her as help some proprietary technology belonging to her people, which are called Imago machines. And this is a concept I made up. It is neurologically, functionally impossible. I made a neuroscientist friend of mine faintly annoyed, and then I told him that he had to just deal with being faintly annoyed. This is how I wanted it to be in the magical far future, which allows a person to inherit the memories and some of the skills of the last person who had their job. So if you are the world's best civil engineer and you build amazing bridges and you grow old and you are near to death, your successor, who's going to be the next bridge building engineer, gets to have all of the things you've learned in your life. So it's a way of preserving institutional continuity. And I invented this for LaSalle because they're a very small station. There's about 30,000 people on there. And they're totally self-sufficient. And I was very interested in how on Earth, with a society that size, you could maintain levels of knowledge, especially in a very dangerous environment like floating out in space with radiation and other accidents and all kinds of things. So Mahit has the imago of her predecessor, the last ambassador to Texplan. His name is Iskander Agavan. And this would normally be great, except the version of him she's got is 15 years out of date, because the actual guy, the actual Iskandar, he went down to Texcalan and he didn't come back for 15 years, so no one has taken a new recording of him. And apparently now he's either missing or dead or otherwise compromised, and the Empire is demanding a new ambassador, so off Mahit goes. And when she gets to the city, the jewel of the world, the heart of the Texcalan Empire, she's met by a woman who's supposed to show her around and be like her local guide, a cultural liaison, whose name is Three Seagrass, and she's from the Information Ministry, which means she's basically a professional spy. And she immediately gets taken into a morgue, and voila, in the morgue is the dead body of Iskander Agavan, and then things go very, very wrong. And I'm not going to spoil the book too much, but essentially, Mahit gets caught up in trying to figure out who killed the original Iskander Agavan, what happened exactly to make the Imago machine version of Iskander she's got in her head malfunction as badly as it begins to do, what Iskander, the dude, had managed to do to make everything so politically completely messed up, and whether she can stop Texcalan from deciding to take over her station once and for all. There's a plot-bearing poetry contest, a couple of riots, and some back-alley neurosurgery along the way.
I'm glad you talked a little bit about things that I was afraid would be spoilers, because if they're spoilers, you spoiled them, not me. Because a lot of them are exactly the questions I thought.
Well, the beginning, to explain the book, you have to spoil it a little, but I haven't gone any farther than about chapter two.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's interesting. I found that a civilization, the empire, so vast and so advanced, but they use a lot of the same technology we have almost, like the InfoFiche stick, like holograms, like wax seals. It was almost like their poetry. Mm-hmm. It was almost like an aesthetic rather than, you know, keeping something that they could have easily have surpassed, but yet keeping it, you know, wax seals.
Yes. And that's very deliberate. One of the things that I decided would be a aesthetic note in building Texcalan was that they like beauty. They like beauty for beauty's sake. They like things that show attention and detail and symbolism. They prefer what are basically like USB drives that you break them open and then there's a holographic letter and the USB drive is sealed with a wax seal to email, because that shows an investment in the communication. And their whole society is full of that kind of stuff. They can do amazing technology indistinguishable from magic things, but the society is interested in physicality, interested in beauty, interested in luxury. I wanted to give a sense of what decadence could look like if decadence was not gaudy, was just intensely uncaring of resource use.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept, because and I know companies like this, and I know people like this, including my brother, that would easily sacrifice the bottom line for something that was aesthetically pleasing. And then I know people like my son, who says to my brother, why? It's the bottom line. Like any kid who's 25 or 30 that's worked at Price Waterhouse, you know, the idea is it's the bottom line. That's what it is. And if you have this poor old lady that you could kick out of her apartment and rent it to somebody else for more, do it, as opposed to the idea that, no, it's better.
As a city planner, I'm rather angry with your son right now.
Well, it's not his fault. He was inculcated.
Well, it's not his fault. The fault is capitalism.
Correct.
I don't want to disparage anyone's individual choices. Just the housing crisis cannot be solved by capitalism. It has to be solved by direct intervention into giving people places to live so that they can, in fact, contribute money back into the economy instead of spending it all on rent.
Yeah, I agree.
Insert rant here. I could go on.
Well, the only thing I'll say is that it's almost like pork bellies now. I didn't realize there's this program. It's called Live Rents. And what it does is that the algorithm just takes in all the rents around your socio-demographic area, and then it concludes, okay, tomorrow you can raise your rent $15, but then the next day you have to lower it $15. And, then I'm thinking, well, your neighbor's paying less than you. Aren't you going to get mad? And they don't, because you're talking about...
They don't know.
Yeah. It's just like I'm charging you a convenience charge of $25 for using your credit card. No kids write checks. No kids are going to go to the office and deliver the check or cash. They will pay the convenience charge of $25, which is pure profit, as opposed to doing anything else. So it's not only is it capitalism, it's...
Well, most kids don't actually have checks because it's very hard to get a bank to give you them now.
That's true. I know. Yes, that's very true. But that's kind of like a colonial mind. I mean, it's just the colonization is much more amorphous.
I wouldn't say that's colonization. I would say that is commodification, which is a different thing. Colonization requires a particular exploitation of a distinct group, not a sort of generalized exploitation of anybody that you can get close enough to exploit.
Say that again.
For me, colonization requires one group deciding that the resources that belong to another group really should belong to them, and taking them and using them for themselves while denying them systematically to a particular group, usually via state control, sometimes via cultural control. The kind of thing you're talking about when you have an app that sets your rent and you don't know what your rent really should be because it's all done algorithmically, that's not colonization. That is the commodification and technological sort of takeover of what had been a person-to-person negotiation. It doesn't require a oppressor group and an oppressed group. It's basically exploiting everyone if you're willing to do it.
But people aren't doing it anymore. That's the thing. That's the thing that's different. It's the information that's doing it. It's the passage of information instantaneously that becomes...
Well, people are always behind information. There is no information that does. There are only people who make algorithms. Information doesn't think.
Yeah, but people either don't think or they accept. And
well, yes, but I mean, and I use this actually in the novel a lot. There is no such thing as an innocent algorithm. An algorithm is built to record very specific things, and it's built by very specific people whose biases, conscious or unconscious, shape what the algorithm will find and put out. An algorithm for finding sort of stochastic rent values has to do with someone looking for, if you build that app at all, you are looking for ways to raise rent. I mean, that's the first baseline.
Correct.
The second baseline is how else are you setting that algorithm to count? Is it just numbers? Is it how many people are in the apartment? Is it what demographics they are and what they're willing to pay? No algorithm is pure. No algorithm is exactly truthful.
Well, that goes back to a little bit of what we were saying before the broadcast, which is whether Empire, which is your bailiwick, if you will, whether whether Empire is inherently good or inherently evil or just arbitrarily one or the other.
I don't believe in
good
saying
or evil.
That anything is inherently good or inherently evil, that nothing is inherently good or inherently evil. Empire on balance is pretty bad. It can make some very beautiful things and create spaces for other beautiful things to flourish. I think of the Pax Mongolica after Genghis Khan conquers, in an incredibly bloody and amazingly destructive fashion, most of Eurasia. There's this 80-year period where travel is safe within that empire, where the Mongol ruling class, it's not really a class, the Mongol ruling group, basically are hiring all the scientists, architects, engineers, and poets and statesmen they can find from anywhere that they've conquered to figure out how to make all of their governments work better. So you have a giant leap in civic technology. And none of that would be possible without the Mongol Empire, or at least it wouldn't be possible that fast. But the price you pay for it is the destruction of hundreds of smaller societies, millions of lives, and a pile of skulls higher than city walls.
Yes.
And is this a good trade-off? Personally, I am not so sure. But there's some arguments to be made that maybe, but the real problem with Empire, the real reason that I feel like Empire cannot be good, is that Empire collapses everything into itself culturally. As one of its merits and its deep flaws is that the culture of the empire expands and infiltrates, and it can absorb and include cultures of colonized places, but more often you get a kind of overall flattening of culture. Like, there's a McDonald's literally everywhere. There is not a country in the world without one McDonald's. And, I mean, if you really like McDonald's, that's fantastic. But what is not there because there is a McDonald's there? That's the question. And
I just got back from Rome, Florence, and Venice, and every McDonald's and every Burger King was completely packed. And I realize it's because there were no Americans in there. And it's And in Japan, they have a holiday where all they serve is Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's amazing.
This is what I mean by cultural imperialism.
Yes,
it's not militarily imposed. It's not state imposed. We don't tax people in Italy to eat at the McDonald's. But American culture has blanketed the world and shifted it. And in some ways, that's been good, and in a lot of ways that's been either an active threat which destroys local culture, or something that just sort of flattens all culture into a sort of monoglot.
Yeah, and the gnomon of that
can be very beautiful.
Well,
but it is flat.
It's like the McDonald's. It's like the Big Mac economic index, by determining the economy of a country by the price of the Big Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And it works really well. It works very,
yeah,
very well. And that goes to what you were saying. But that reminds me of the title of your book, A Memory Called Empire, coupled with your first epigraph. And that implies, and I'm not going to again spoil anything, but it implies that empire doesn't actually exist. It's only the memory of it that allows it to continue on. And I don't quite understand
that. That's a complicated question.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I wouldn't say that that's actually what I'm saying with that title and that epigram, but I would say that it is the construction of the ideology of empire, the belief that an empire is, that that the British Empire, the sun never sets on the British Empire, that belief, the strength of that, which is still having effects today vis-a-vis Brexit, and the idea that the British shouldn't have to listen to anyone else. This seems to have been a terrible idea. But the idea behind empire survives empire, can be an endless source of attempts to recreate it. There's a phrase I used in the book, and which I have also used in academic writing about these subjects, which is the empire survives even if the emperor doesn't. You don't need an emperor as long as you have a system. And the system is, like all systems, upheld by belief.
Yeah, it's very similar to what's happening today. And I don't want to get into politics, but you started it with Brexit. But if you look,
notice I picked Brexit and not my own country.
well, yeah, and I was going to go to Trump, which I can spend hours every day ranting to, which I will do to random people anywhere. But he's not the problem. It's the times made him. The times made this man. And, you know, it's like one of
the... Well, he is a problem, very distinctly.
Well, he's horrible. He's the worst thing that's ever happened.
The possibility of a man like him is one which emerges organically from the time period, from the pressures on American society, from the way that we consume our media, from what seems to provide catharsis and relief for people who don't have very much, which horrifyingly seems to be racism. Hurrah!
But it's what I was saying about information. If Twitter didn't exist, then he wouldn't exist.
No, he would exist. He
no,
would
well, without way without to, Twitter, it would be tough.
He existed before Twitter.
Well, there was...
In fact, the entire The Apprentice stuff mostly happened before Twitter.
Well, yeah, almost all of it. You're right. Well, it's like, you know, when I flew back last night, there was a fly on my plane. The fly got on in London, and he's getting off in New York. I mean, that could change the entire...
Ah, a plague vector.
Yeah, it's the butterfly effect. But, I mean, yeah, it's things are not the same as what they were. And I don't know what I'm getting at, but there's something in your book that resonates with me, and I don't know exactly what it is. I mean, your expertise and the lineage of your studies is ineluctably connected with your book, but at the same time, you're also talking about a quantum change in the way, for want of a better word, government works. And I think it's just because, you know, going back to the anachronisms, you know, when she's imprisoned, if you will, after the bombing, and then she gets her room to sleep in and all that. And then when she gets a change of clothes, you know, they give her panties and essentially a bra. And it's like, okay, well, that's
why
not...
Why wouldn't there be panties and a bra in the future?
I don't know, because there wouldn't be. I mean, there's scotch tape and zippers. I understand.
With all due respect, women will still need to hold up their breasts, and everyone needs underwear.
I would disagree with you, but it's... look, why do we have electric outlets the way they were when Edison invented them? And why is the light bulb that gives off 90% heat and 10% light? Why does that exist? Why do we still have this stuff?
We have LEDs.
Well, now we do, but you still use the same iron, and you still zip up your pants the same way. Is it just, what, in paper clips?
It's functional.
But why was it the best?
Why would you change something that's functional?
To make it better.
Why would you change something that's functional?
Toilet paper,
better
Kleenex?
Doesn't mean, like, just because you can doesn't mean you want to. If something works and you don't have to think about it.
Railroad
it
tracks
makes you
don't.
Happy in some way, like it's beautiful or pleasing or just familiar. Why would you change it?
Because, for example, the Acela train between Washington and Boston can't go the speed it's designed to go because the railroad tracks are the same as what they were in 1870 if they were cambered.
Well, yes, but that's a problem. That doesn't work, so you need to change it.
I don't know. Where are we? What are we talking about? Where are we going?
I have no idea.
It's fun. But I want to go. Okay, last thing is bra and underwear. So where did I go from that? Yes. Did you mean any of this to be kind of a warning to us today? No, yes?
Not at all. I don't write warnings. I write ideas. I don't think that science fiction has ever been very good at predicting futures. Even the things that seem like they've predicted some things, like if you look at late 80s, early 90s cyberpunk, William Gibson, Neal Stephenson, Pat Cadigan, they got a lot of the weird stuff that exists right now, but all of the flavor is different, and they missed the surveillance state, and they missed the way that we pass information around.
I don't know. Neuromancer got a lot of stuff right.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying Neuromancer got a lot of stuff right and still got a lot of stuff wrong.
True.
I don't think that science fiction is very good at predicting the future. What science fiction is good at is thinking about in ways that expand an idea outward as far as it can go, looking at the present. That's at least how I think about it. But also, I wrote most of this book long before 2016. I wrote this book because of things that happened in the 11th century.
That's true, you did. Which is very incredibly obscure to a lot of people. Which I'm not saying it limits your audience, but what I'm saying is it's not something that you're going to read every day. It's different.
And that seems to have been working in my favor.
It should. So. It definitely should. It's just that, by me saying you don't often or ever see a book like yours is not implying that there's anything wrong with it. It's just saying...
Oh, no, I didn't think you meant that.
No, not at all. And, it's really interesting. You're so absolute about everything. You're sure of everything
really?
You say. There's no doubt in your mind about anything. It doesn't seem like...
I am made of doubt. But... I think in my sense of wanting to resist absolutism, I tend to veer very hard towards being absolute about middle positions, which is not to say that I'm a centrist, because I'm really not.
Would you be a good empress?
I would like to say yes, which means that the answer is no.
Yeah, that's true. It's just like the... what was the part Kate Blanchett played in The Lord of the Rings? She was the elf and
Galadriel.
Galadriel, and then
all would love me in despair.
Yeah, and then she held the ring, and then she rose to this incredible power, and she kind of laughed, and she said, "This is what I could do if I wanted to." That's the hardest thing in the world to do, because power. Even if you're a dog catcher, the power you have corrupts you absolutely. And that's something about
it. Unless you think about it a lot. Because people have power. Like, you can't not have power. You have power every day. Sometimes in very small ways, but even little babies have power. They have the power of acquiring attention. And of taking up time.
Do you think power
so
always...
So, it's not like you can abdicate from power. So, it's more like, what are you going to do with it? What do you want to do with it?
Do you think it always corrupts?
No.
I do.
I think sometimes it does. I think often it does. But it's not really the power that I think corrupts. I think it is the situations and societies that you become part of when you are powerful, which are often... more oriented towards maintaining that power than they are using it, and also in a sort of gleeful and joyous recognition of one another's power, as opposed to using what you have to point outward and do something useful with it. And I think those situations are very corrupting.
As a city planner, or a theoretical city planner, how did you, in your mind, almost as if you were building a model, you know, with six directions, how did you design and then put on paper the city that's the core of your empire?
Well, sadly, not actually a lot of it ended up being drawn on maps. I tried once and did very badly at trying to figure out, like, distances. The palace is shaped like a six-pointed star, but that's easy. The rest of the city is a bunch of kind of concentric circles with spokes between them. But again, that's like really general, really, really far out. And one of the reasons, aside from I didn't have a piece of paper big enough and I'm not actually all that good at drawing at all, that I didn't really design it down to brass tacks, is that I very strongly believe that cities are organic, that cities are surprising, that cities find their own uses for things. So I didn't want to pin it down. I wanted it to, like, be a little bit amorphous, so that if I needed something, if I needed a place where a back alley neurosurgeon would live, I could make one up and figure out how it would be attached to other parts of the city. And also, it's a city that covers 2/3 of a planet. It's real big and real weird, and parts of it don't feel like it is even in the same planet as other parts of it. It's like if you could go by bullet train from Copenhagen to
Shanghai,
Cape Town in like 6 hours.
Which will happen.
Yes. I hope so.
Or by Elon Musk will happen, you know.
Elon Musk's tunnel thing doesn't work.
Well, he's given up on the Boring Company. But no, I'm talking about suborbital flight that will get you from here to
China. Oh, yeah, suborbital flight, sure.
Yeah, that will definitely happen. Was your city idealized? Is it an idealized city? And if it,
I tried not to have it be. I want it to have all of the grit and ick and reality of a real place.
Like New York?
Like, yes, Manhattan? Like New York. Hopefully like Manhattan. But also like other parts of New York and like other cities I've lived in.
And that's what was so fascinating about the book, besides the bras and the underwear, is that it's so much like us and so different than us. And that was the balance that I think was really held very nicely in your mind and in your hands as you wrote the book. It reminds you so much of where we are. And then, like I said in the introduction, but it's so incredibly alien as well. And so the book's written. You're the mother of the book. The book is now out in the world. It's doing what it's doing. And readers get the chance to, you no longer have the chance. The readers have the chance to decide what they think about it. And especially since it's book one.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like that? Do you like the idea? Again, because I know you're not absolute, but again, you do seem very sure of yourself. Do you like?
That's different from being an absolutist. I am sure of myself. I know what I'm saying.
See, you just did it.
Yes, exactly.
So do you like the idea of readers being able to? Yeah, especially you. Do you like the idea of the reader being able to interpret this world, expand upon it?
I love it. I want it to not be mine anymore. I made it. I gave it to the world. It's not for me now. I wrote it for me. But I, having written it, it's not for me anymore when I decided I wanted to publish it. It's for everybody. And people will take what they take from it. They'll bring their own perspectives and their own long chains of memory and their experiences, and they'll see what they see in the book. And if that's what I put there, that's neat. And if it's something that I didn't put there, then it's no less genuine because it's their experience plus my words made a thing.
Yeah, it's like I have an independent bookstore, and also your book's on the front table, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And yeah, it is on the front table. I just saw it as I left. My favorite thing in the bookstore is when a little kid climbs up the library ladder at the back in the used book section and is looking for a specific book. But he also sees the book on the left and he sees the book on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those books may change his life. And that's what I was getting at when I was talking about your book, when you thought, maybe you thought I was being somewhat pejorative, but I wasn't, is the idea that you might be the book on the left or on the right.
I would be honored if that
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. So what's book two going to be then? I read your interview about it, but tell us what it's going to be.
So book two is both a direct sequel and kind of a standalone. It's probably better to read if you read book one, but it should be readable if you haven't. And also you can stop after book one. That was super important to me, that I was going to write two complete arcs. But it is what happens 6 months later. It is about, I'm trying not to spoil book one. It is about what happens with the threat on the edge of the empire. Some of it takes place on a battleship. It's got more points of view than just Mahit this time, though Mahit is there. And it's really, if the first book was about sort of identity and like cultural identification, the second book is about incomprehensibility and conflict. I was very much inspired by an article I read in grad school, actually, God, like 10 years ago now, which was about one of the meetings between Cortez and Moctezuma, where the meeting was supposed to be a negotiation and it ended in a bloodbath. And the article was about how the ways in which both sides tried to communicate made no sense to the other side. Not just were confusing or like were offensive, but they literally made no sense. The way that the Aztecs seemed to Cortez and the way that Cortez and his people seemed to the Aztecs was not comprehensible in the construction of their worldview. And humans have this really horrific tendency to react to incomprehensibility and like category violation, like this should not be, with violence, often apocalyptic violence. Make the bad thing stop. Make me not have to integrate that into my world. So that's a concept that I've been fascinated with and horrified by for a very long time. And I wanted to take all of these concepts of universal empire and these characters who I've become very, very fond of and make them have to make some really nasty decisions if they can't figure out how to talk to each other at all.
And all those decisions, in my opinion, are based on fear.
A lot of them, yeah.
You know, it's funny, too. The book is very cinematic. I can see it being optioned for something, either a movie or a season one, season two, season three thing on Netflix. But you would have to change the names, whether you like it or not. And, but don't you?
Oh, I doubt that.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, of course you would. Nobody's going to let you use those names.
We'll see. It hasn't been optioned yet, but we'll see what happens.
And they'd have to compress it to a certain extent. But it really does seem very cinematic because in my mind's eyes, I can see her room. I'm not spoiling it. No, you already said it. I can see him laying on that slab.
Mm-hmm.
It's very visual. Which I didn't expect to be when I started, especially since I read the Wikipedia stuff about you guys first. I didn't expect it to be cinematic or that accessible visually as it was. Did you care? Did you start out thinking?
I'm a very visual writer. I have always been. I really love imagery. I really love using description to deepen a story and push it. I often see scenes that I'm writing Vivian, my wife, she says that she sees it like it's a film, with camera shots and everything. I don't. For me, when she writes, she sees her stuff like that. When I write, it's like a series of photographs, snapshots.
Huh.
Sometimes a single gesture that moves, that's the important gesture. But it is very, very visual. And that's just how I think, and that's how I've always written.
You know, it's funny. I just thought of a better movie. It should be you and your wife sitting at a table in an Italian restaurant and just doing My Dinner with Andre. I think that would really work well.
We would be entertaining.
I know. It would be a good movie. And the waiter would come in every once in a while and bring you or whatever. And yeah, I would do that one. Well, so with that, I hope you'll come. Well, you may be totally sick of me, but I would love you to come back when the second one is out. And I will not mention.
Absolutely.
I won't mention anything about underwear. I promise.
I actually think it's an interesting question. Like, what would space underwear be like? It's just that I think that it would be pretty much similar to current underwear because humans haven't changed bodily form.
I don't know what they wear on the space shuttle. I know I've seen tons of interviews with women who are floating. I have no idea.
I know. Yes, but there's gravity everywhere in the book.
Yes, I know. There is. Did you ever see that movie Moon with Sam Rockwell?
I have not seen this movie. I'm actually pretty bad at movies.
Me too. But I think you might like it. Anyway. Well, anyway, okay, so I really enjoyed the book. I really enjoy having it in my bookstore, and I look forward to talking with you again. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon then. Well, that was an interesting one. She's way, way too smart for me, and so is her wife. But it's a pleasure for me trying to, you know, it's like when you play tennis. You always want to play tennis with someone that's better than you, not someone who's worse. Playing with someone who's worse really sucks. It's a waste of time and it's really boring. But playing against someone who's better is such, you know what? Basically, that's what life is about. That's the idea, you know. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? And you should always be able to reach for something and touch it, and then the rest of your life should be about grasping it. To wax metaphysical. So anyway, in any event, we got tons of good books coming up. Oh, I really like this book, A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martin. And there's a sequel coming out and a sequel to that coming out. And come by the bookstore and take a look at it. It's got a great, I didn't mention that. It's got a great cover. I should have said that. I always like talking about covers. Anyway, we have two-time National Book Award finalist Edwidge Danticat, who's discussing her short story collection, which I love short story collections, called Everything Inside. And Orson Scott Card, who wrote Ender's Game, you know, one of the, and the Ender's Game, Speaker for the Dead, Xenocide. So many great books and such a great trilogy and unlucky movie. But he'll join us to discuss his latest, Lost and Found. And I forced Rebecca to get him because he's been kind of like my hero, except for one book he wrote, for a long, long time. Okay, that was good. I really liked that. And I will not talk with you guys, but kind of talk with you next week on another edition of The Avid Reader. Thanks.